In the last 8 years or so, he has been very much hampered by his health problems. Even then, he has managed to produce some interesting work. Nash is clearly one of the most individualistic among the presently active mathematicians. He does not work systematically at long-range problems, whose progress along more or less foreseen lines can be rather confidently expected, but is more the pioneer type, who proceeds along new paths. He is thus rather unpredictable, but in a way it makes it appear more likely that he might score new successes in spite of his ups and downs in health. Any contribution in mathematics on the level of his past work would be extremely valuable, and so I feel strongly that he should be supported. It's not clear exactly when Nash returned to Cambridge, but when he did, he was extremely ill. After a terrible scene, John David locked him out on the porch on a freezing night. Nash told Pelé at some point that he'd stopped taking medication. "Why, when they were making you well, did you stop taking drugs?" He answered, "If I take drugs, I stop hearing the voices." A letter from Nash to Moser captured something of Nash's state of mind when he returned to Cambridge in late May. Nash gives his return address as Heilvigklang University, Harbin, Manchuria. "The oblast in Russia, on the Manchurian border. There's the city of Birbidzhan. If all the atomic powers of the Security Council of the United Nations did an action, and they were numbered 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, then one would be able to say nobody did it, everybody did it, all did it." The letter was signed Changsin, New River. Feige ran into John on the subway. His manner was slippery, shady, sly, almost ashamed, a peculiar smile pulling at the corners of his mouth. She asked where he was going. He answered, "Home to Roanoke to stay with my mother for a while." Nash left Cambridge on June 26th, leaving his apartment in a shambles. He drove to Princeton, stayed in a hotel for propriety rather than with Alicia and John Charles, and proceeded to Roanoke a few days later. Feige called Joe Cohn and said she'd get a moving van and send Nash his furniture. I felt so guilty that I said to myself, "I'll get his stuff moved out." I did, too, everything except the bathroom scale. I never even went into the bathroom. Anna Rosa, Cohn's wife, went into the Parker Street apartment. There were folded bags, one upon another, and cereal boxes. Not awful, but signs of compulsion. A few days later, Norman Levinson wrote to Martha. "For the past 2 years, John has been employed as a research associate on my contract. John doesn't want to live here, and I couldn't convince him to stay. A few days ago, John left 38 Parker Street. There were piles of rubbish, hints of bank accounts, also other accounts here and abroad. John was very disturbed this past year, but in 1965 to 1966, he functioned very well and did fine work." Chapter 44. A Man All Alone in a Strange World. Roanoke, 1967-70. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge. Emily Dickinson, number 280. The summer Nash turned 40 in 1968, he looked into the mirror in the bathroom of his mother's apartment, and saw what he later called a cadaver, almost. Hollow-cheeked, sunken-eyed, gray-haired, with his shoulders hunched forward, he looked more like an old man than one just entering middle age. He wrote to a friend, "You should pity me. Aging and drying processes have taken their toll." Images of death in life crowded his mind. In a letter to another friend, he invoked the images of the Parsi Towers of Silence in Bombay, where followers of Zoroaster leave their dead to be devoured by vultures. He'd been living in Roanoke for nearly a year. He still had his Rambler and some savings, but 8 years of illness had exhausted his former wife and friends and ruined much of his credit with the world. He had nowhere else to go. For him, Roanoke, a pretty little city at the foot of the Appalachians and the headquarters of the Norfolk and Western Railroad, was the end of the line. He lived with Virginia in a small garden apartment on Grandin Road. Martha and Charlie lived a few streets away. No one knew him there. The schizophrenic's existence had been compared to that of the person living in a glass prison, pounding on the walls, unable to be heard, yet very visible. Martha recalled in 1994, Roanoke was not a good place to be. There were no intellectuals there. He'd be too much alone. He would wander around town, whistling. On many days, he simply paced round and round the apartment, his long fingers curled around one of Virginia's delicate Japanese teacups, a souvenir of her years-long-ago summer in Berkeley, sipping Formosa oolong, whistling Bach. The sleepwalker's gait and fixed faraway expression gave few hints of the vast and unending dramas unfolding in his mind. "Apparently I'm simply passing time visiting my mother," he wrote, "but actually I've been under persecutions which I'm hoping will ease." His daily rounds extended no farther than the library or the shops at the end of Grandin Road, but in his own mind he traveled to the remotest reaches of the globe. Cairo, Zeebak, Kabul, Bangui, Thebes, Guyana, Mongolia. In these faraway places he lived in refugee camps, foreign embassies, prisons, bomb shelters. At other times he felt that he was inhabiting an inferno, a purgatory, or a polluted heaven, a decayed, rotting house infested by rats and termites and other vermin. His identities, like the return addresses on his letters, were like the skins of an onion. Underneath each one lurked another. He was Corpse, a Palestinian Arab refugee, a great Japanese shogun, C-1423, Esau, Lomdur, Xinjiang, Job, Jorup Castro, Janos Norsis, even at times a mouse. His companions were samurai, devils, prophets, Nazis, priests, and judges, baleful deities, Napoleon, Iblis, Mora, Satan, Platinum Man, Titan, Nahipotliron, Napoleon Schickelgruber threatened him. He lived in constant fear of annihilation, both of the world, genocide, Armageddon, the apocalypse, final day of judgment, day of resolution of singularities, and of himself, death and bankruptcy. Certain dates struck him as ominous, among them May 29th. Persistent, complex, and compelling delusions are among the defining symptoms of schizophrenia. Delusions are false beliefs, beliefs that constitute a dramatic rejection of consensual reality. Often they involve misinterpretations of perceptions or experiences. They are thought nowadays to arise primarily because of the gross distortions in sensory data and the way thought and emotion are processed deep in the brain. Thus their convoluted and mysterious logic is sometimes seen as the product of the mind's solitary struggle to make sense of the strange and uncanny. E. Fuller Torrey, a researcher at St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C., and author of Surviving Schizophrenia, calls them logical outgrowths of what the brain is experiencing, as well as heroic efforts to maintain some sort of mental equilibrium. The syndrome we now call schizophrenia was once called dementia praecox, but in fact the delusional states typical of schizophrenia often have little in common with the dementia associated with, for example, Alzheimer's disease. Rather than cloudiness, confusion, and meaninglessness, there is hyper-awareness, over-acuity, and an uncanny wakefulness. Urgent preoccupations, elaborate rationales, and ingenious theories dominate. However literal, tangential, or self-contradictory, thought is not random, but adheres to obscure and hard-to-understand rules. And the ability accurately to apprehend certain aspects of everyday reality remains curiously intact. Had anyone asked Nash what year it was, or who was in the White House, or where he was living, he could no doubt have answered perfectly accurately, had he wished to. Indeed, even as he entertained the most surreal notions, Nash displayed an ironic awareness that his insights were essentially private, unique to himself, and bound to seem strange or unbelievable to others. This concept that I want to describe will perhaps sound absurd, was the sort of preface of which he was quite capable. His sentences were filled with phrases like, consider, as if, maybe thought of as if he were conducting a thought experiment, or realizing that someone reading what he wrote would have to translate it into another language. Like all other manifestations of the syndrome, delusions are not unique to schizophrenia. They can be present in a variety of mental disorders, including mania, depression, and a variety of somatic illnesses. But the types of delusions that Nash suffered from are particularly characteristic of schizophrenia, specifically of paranoid schizophrenia, the variant of the syndrome from which Nash apparently suffered. Their content was, as it often is, both grandiose and persecutory, often shifting from one to the other in the space of moments, or even including both at the same time. At different times, as we know, Nash thought of himself as uniquely powerful, as a prince or an emperor. At other times, he thought of himself as extraordinarily weak and vulnerable, as a refugee or a defendant in a trial. As is quite typical, his beliefs were what is called referential, in that he believed that a host of environmental clues, from newspaper passages to particular numbers, were specifically directed at him, and that he alone was capable of appreciating their true meaning. His delusions were multiple, a particularly common feature of paranoid schizophrenia, although all were organized in subtle ways around coherent themes. Bizarreness is thought to be especially characteristic of schizophrenic delusions. Nash's delusions were clearly implausible, difficult to penetrate, and not obviously derived from life experiences. Yet they were less bizarre on the whole than many delusions reported by other people with schizophrenia, and their connections to Nash's life history and his immediate circumstances, though indirect, were often discernible. Or would have been had anyone who knew him well been willing to study in the same spirit as the loyal wife of Balzac's Louis Lambert. Many people with schizophrenia believe that their thoughts have been captured by outside forces, or that outside forces have inserted thoughts into their minds. But such beliefs did not seem to play a predominant role in Nash's thinking. Occasionally, as in Rome, he might think that thoughts were being inserted directly into his mind via machines, or as in Cambridge in early 1959, that his actions were being directed by God. But by and large, Nash maintained a sense of himself or selves as the primary actor. And many of his beliefs, such as that he was a conscientious objector in danger of being drafted, that he was stateless, that mathematicians belonging to the American Mathematical Society were ruining his career, that various persons posing as sympathizers were conspiring with malevolent intent to have him incarcerated in a mental institution, were no more implausible than, say, a belief that one is being spied on by the police or the CIA. Thus, in a sense, the breakdown of reality and boundaries between self and outside world had limits for him, even in Roanoke. In particular, although Nash later referred to his delusional states as the time of my irrationality, he kept the role of the thinker, the theorist, the scholar trying to make sense of complicated phenomena. He was perfecting the ideology of liberation from slavery, finding a simple method, creating a model or a theory. The actions he referred to are mostly feats of mind or involve language. At most, he was negotiating or petitioning or trying to persuade. His letters were Joycean monologues, written in a private language of his own invention, full of dreamlike logic and subtle non sequiturs. His theories were astronomical, game theoretical, geopolitical, and religious. And while years later Nash often referred to pleasant aspects of the delusional state, it seems clear that these waking dreams were extremely unpleasant, full of anxiety and dread. Before the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, he explained he was a left-wing Palestinian Arab refugee, a member of the PLO, and a refugee making a G-indent in Israel's border, petitioning Arab nations to protect him from falling under the power of the Israeli state. Soon afterward, he imagined that he was a go-board whose four sides were labeled Los Angeles, Boston, Seattle, and Bluefield. He was covered with white stones representing Confucians and black stones representing Mohammedans. The First Order game was being played by his sons John David and John Charles. The Second Order derivative game was an ideological conflict between me personally and the Jews collectively. A few weeks later, he was thinking of another go-board whose four sides were labeled with cars that he had owned, Studebaker, Olds, Mercedes, Plymouth Belvedere. He thought it might be possible to construct an elaborate oscilloscope display, a repentingness function. It seemed to him also that certain truths were visible in the stars. He realized that Saturn is associated with Esau and Adam, with whom he identified, and that Titan, Saturn's second moon, was Jacob, as well as an enemy of Buddha, Iblis. "I've discovered a B-theory of Saturn. The B-theory is simply that Jack Bricker is Satan. Iblisianism is a frightening problem connected to the final day of judgment." At this point, the grandiose delusions in which Nash was a powerful figure, the Prince of Peace, the Left Foot of God, and the Emperor of Antarctica, were no longer in evidence. Instead, the theme became predominantly persecutory. He discerned that the root of all evil, as far as my personal life is concerned, life history, are Jews. In particular, Jack Bricker, who is Hitler, a trinity of evil comprised of Mora, Iblis, and Napoleon. These were, he said, simply Jack Bricker in relation to me. At another point, he said, referring to Bricker, "Imagine if there would be a person who pats a guy on the back with compliments and praises, while at the same time stabbing him in the abdomen with a deadly rabbit punch." Seeing the picture so clearly, he concluded that he must petition the Jews and also mathematicians and Arabs, so that they have the opportunity for redress of wrongs, which must, however, not be too openly revealed. He also had the idea that he must turn to churches, foreign governments, and civil rights organizations for help. In the story of Jacob and Esau, told in Genesis, Nash saw a parable full of meaning for his own life. Jacob and Esau are brothers, the sons of Isaac and Rebekah, who love each other. Esau is the eldest, and his father Isaac loves him, but Rebekah, their mother, loves Jacob more. As the story unfolds, Esau is twice supplanted by Jacob. First, Jacob tricks Esau into making a bad bargain and selling his birthright. Then Jacob steals the blessing of the now blind Isaac, who had intended it for Esau. He does so by impersonating his brother. When Esau discovers Jacob's deception, Isaac rejects his claim. "See, away from the fatness of the earth shall your home be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when you break loose, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Esau, full of hatred for his brother, tells himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Nash believed that he had been cast out. "I've been in a situation of loss of favor," and ostracized. He was constantly threatened with bankruptcy and expropriation. If accounts are held for a trustee, in effect, who is as good as defunct through lack of rational consistency, it's as if accounts are held for persons suffering in an inferno. They can never benefit from them because it's as if they were supposed to come from the inferno to the bank offices and collect, but they need, as it were, a revolutionary ending of the inferno before having any sort of possibility of benefiting from their accounts. There is a presumption of guilt. Punishment, penitence, contrition, atonement, confession, and repentance are constant themes, along with fears of exposure and the need for indirection and secrecy, and seem directly connected but not limited to his feelings about homosexuality. He refers to the really dubious things that I have done in all the history of my personal life, including draft dodging, truancy. Arrests, trials, and imprisonment were also recurring themes. Like Joseph K. in Kafka's novel The Trial, Nash imagined that he was on trial sufficiently complete in absentia. He recognizes that it is as if the accused is his own chief accuser. The road of self-accusation is a road that leads to death, not redemption. He thinks of a court of inquiry, investigating the life histories and interactions of Jacob and Esau, whom he identifies as Bricker and himself. These are guilty, fearful dreams. Nash's state of imprisonment did not, it seems, refer to his illness, for he did not regard himself as ill except physically. It was existential. To Eleanor he wrote, "You see, you must sympathize more with the true needs of liberation. Liberation from slavery, liberation from castration, liberation from prison, liberation from isolation. I'm a refugee, in fact, from false symbols and dangerous symbols." At times he felt that he was in danger of crucifixion. His own needs, he said, were to be free and to be safe and for friends. He was always, he said, in fear of death, Indian style, through an Armageddon with Iblis at the Day of Judgment. Even in these very dark hours he clung to a vision of liberation, which later became, more concretely, a wish for sexual liberation. "I'm hoping fervently to be saved, delivered before reaching 40 in age," he had written a few weeks before his birthday. "One cannot substitute free life and love of the 40s for the lost possibilities of the 20s and 30s and also teens." Nash was acutely aware of the passage of time. "It does seem to me that I've been as if the victim of an excessively long wait for liberation. It's as if there wasn't a ransom forthcoming, as if from Kuwait, which would have really substantially shortened the time of waiting for me." He was waiting for deliverance. "I see, it seems surprisingly clearly, how there's, as it were, a time of grace before that time, a precious time of grace, which is forever lost if not seized carpe diem and fully effective in its significance." Nash was also hearing voices, voices that frightened him. "My head is as if a bloated windbag with voices which dispute within." Hallucinations can involve any of the senses, hearing, smell, taste, touch, sight. But voices, one or several, familiar or strange, but distinct from one's own thoughts, are the most characteristic of schizophrenia. These are quite distinct from the hallucinations that are part of religious experience, or the humming inside one's head, hearing one's name called occasionally, or hallucinations that occur while falling asleep or waking up. The content of schizophrenic hallucinations can be benign, but they usually involve ridicule, criticism, and threats, typically related to the content of the delusional theme. The integration of voices with thought can produce an acute sense of reality. The so-called negative symptoms of schizophrenia are, most clinicians agree, even more crippling than the delusions and hallucinations. The terms used to describe them are derived from the Greek, affective flattening, eulogia, and avolition. There was no trace of the sharp looks, the enthusiastic gesturing, the brash body language that announced, "I'm Nash with a capital N." His face was blank, his eyes empty, as if the fires of delusion had consumed everything that was once alive and left an empty husk. One could feel comforted if one could believe that Nash, at this terrible time in his life, was at least spared the sight of his own condition. One of the consequences of chronic schizophrenia, noted long ago, and verified since by numerous studies, is a curious insensitivity to physical pain. This insensitivity is often so great that there are high rates of premature deaths from physical illnesses among schizophrenics, at least in the era when such people spent most of their lives in institutions. Might there not be a similar dulling that would anesthetize one to psychic pain? Possibly. But for Nash there were moments of lucid self-knowledge, unbearable in their sadness. "So long a time has passed. I feel there are many sad tragedies. Today I feel very sad and depressed." It is often difficult to distinguish the effects of disease from those of its treatment, but Nash's condition during the 2.5 years he spent in Roanoke was probably almost purely the consequence of his disease. 6 years had passed since Nash had received insulin treatments, and well over a year since he had been taking neuroleptics regularly. While some of his memory loss was no doubt a result of the insulin treatments of the first half of 1961, and some of his extreme quietness in the early months following his return to Cambridge no doubt reflected the side effects of stelazine, his condition in Roanoke is a strong testament that lassitude, indifference, and the peculiarities of his thought were primarily the consequences of his illness and not of the early attempts to treat it. The popular view that antipsychotics were chemical straitjackets that suppressed clear thinking and voluntary activity seems not to be borne out in Nash's case. If anything, the only periods when he was relatively free of hallucinations, delusions, and the erosion of will were the periods following either insulin treatment or the use of antipsychotics. In other words, rather than reducing Nash to a zombie, medication seemed to have reduced zombie-like behavior. Nash was clearly among the majority of those with schizophrenia who benefited from traditional antipsychotics. These drugs were the only ones available between 1952 and 1988, when the more effective clozapine arrived on the scene. Peter Newman, an economist at Johns Hopkins, was editing a volume of important contributions to mathematical economics. He wanted to include Nash's NAS note on Nash equilibrium. The first problem was finding him. I found him teaching or something at a small women's college near Roanoke. I wrote to him there to ask his permission to reprint the article. What I got back was an envelope on which my address was written in different colored crayons. There was also a list of yous in different languages, du, vu, you, etc., and a plea for universal brotherhood. There was nothing inside the envelope at all. I then asked the in-house editor at the Johns Hopkins Press to call Nash. He did, and he said it was the strangest telephone conversation he'd ever had in his life. Then we tried Solomon Lefschetz, since he was the one who sponsored the note. Calling Lefschetz wasn't easy either. Lefschetz only said, ah, yes, he is not what he was. So I had to give up. Later, when the book was reviewed, reviewers chided me for not including the Nash equilibrium. Nash was constantly fearful that Martha and Virginia would hospitalize him again. As he said in one letter, it is the mechanism of how all the persons involved would collaborate in hospitalizing me, which endangers me and which I fear. Most letters from this period end with a paragraph like the following. Let me beg humbly of you that you will favor the view that I ought to be guarded against the danger of hospitalization in the mental hospital, involuntarily or falsely, simply for personal intellectual survival as a conscious and reasonably conscientious human being, and good memory retention. For Virginia, Nash's illness was something that Martha later called, in her tactful and understated way, a private sorrow. Virginia never talked about it with the few acquaintances she had in Roanoke, mostly people she had met playing bridge, and only rarely with Martha. Her friends couldn't possibly have understood what it was like for her. It was also a practical nightmare. Nash was making so many long-distance telephone calls that Virginia had to put a lock on her phone. Martha, whose second child was born in 1969, was at least angry. It was so frustrating day by day, you wondered, is this ever going to get any better? She realized at least that Roanoke was not a kind environment. Only one time did I ask for help, recalled Martha. The minister stopped me after church and told me I should be helping my mother more. He didn't ask whether I needed help. Later on I called and asked would he come to call. He didn't come. The retired minister came, but he wasn't the one I wanted. Virginia and Nash were nearly evicted from their apartment at one point. Martha's voice is still full of outrage 30 years later. There had been a fire that started in the incinerator. Nash was home at the time. He called the fire department. The landlord accused John of setting it, Martha recalled. He had talked to the neighbors who were up in arms. They found this large, strange man who walked around the grounds of the apartment complex alarming. It was only by begging that Martha was able to convince the landlord to let Virginia and Nash move back in. Virginia died shortly before Thanksgiving in 1969. Afterward, Nash was sure there was something sinister about her death. He also felt that perhaps he had done wrong by going to the corner store to buy her whiskey. Martha recalled, when Mother died, it was not a good time. We weren't close. He felt threatened. He felt that I would put him in a hospital. At this point, Eleanor got a court order to force Nash to continue child support payments. When his money had run out, Virginia had taken over the payments. She also left small legacies for both her grandsons. Nash then lived briefly with Martha and Charlie, but Martha found it impossible to cope with her brother. Once Mother was gone, I couldn't clean with him in my home. I was here with the children, and he's wandering around drinking tea and whistling. He'd take ideas and twist them into something strange. Martha arranged to have Nash committed right after Christmas. After Mother died, I was afraid he'd leave town. I was hoping to get the hospital to appoint a committee so he could get Social Security and also get it for his son. We went to a judge. We got a court order. The court sent the police to pick him up. We had my mother's lawyer, Leonard Muse. You could get someone committed for observation. You didn't have to establish anything very drastic. In the hospital, they decided whether to keep somebody. DeJarnette decided that John had paranoid ideas, but that he was capable of maintaining himself. Nash was released from DeJarnette State Sanatorium in Stanton, Virginia, in February. He wrote a final letter to Martha, breaking off all relations with her because of her role in his hospitalization. Then he boarded a bus for Princeton. Chapter 45, Phantom of Fine Hall, Princeton, 1970s. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Emily Dickinson, number 435. An impersonal new granite-clad tower, built with defense dollars at the height of the Vietnam War, had replaced the old Fine Hall and neighboring Jadwin Hall. Math and physics majors spent most of their waking hours below ground where the architects had situated the library, which had formerly occupied the highest floor of Old Fine, as well as the new computer center. Within a few days or weeks, the embryo scientist or mathematician would discover a very peculiar, thin, silent man walking the halls night and day, with sunken eyes and a sad, immobile face. On rare occasions, they might catch a glimpse of the wraith, usually clad in khaki pants, plaid shirt, and bright red high-top keds, printing painstakingly on one of the numerous blackboards that lined the subterranean corridors linking Jadwin and New Fine. More often, students would emerge from an 8 a.m. lecture to find an enigmatic epistle written the night before. Mao Zedong's bar mitzvah was 13 years, 13 months, and 13 days after Brezhnev's circumcision, for example. Or, I agree with Harvard, there is a brain flat. Or a letter from Nikita Khrushchev to Moses with arcane mathematical statements involving the factoring of very long 10 to 15 digit numbers into two large primes. Nobody knew where they came from, recalled Mark Raboul, who graduated in 1977. Nobody knew what they meant. Eventually, some sophomore or junior would clue in the newcomer that the author of the messages, a.k.a. the Phantom, was a mathematical genius who had flipped while giving a lecture, while trying to solve an impossibly difficult problem, after discovering that someone else had scooped him on a major result, or upon learning that his wife had fallen in love with a mathematical rival. He had friends in high places at the university, the older student would add. Students were not to bother him. Among the students, the Phantom was often held up as a cautionary figure. Anybody who was too much of a grind or who lacked social graces was warned that he or she was going to wind up like the Phantom. Yet if a new student complained that having him around made him feel uncomfortable, he was immediately warned he was a better mathematician than you'll ever be. Few students ever exchanged a word with the Phantom, although some of the brasher ones occasionally bummed a cigarette or asked for a light, for the Phantom was now a heavy smoker. One new physics student once erased two or three of the messages only to encounter the Phantom in front of the blackboard, writing a few days later, sweating, trembling, and practically crying. The student never erased another. Students and young faculty members studied the Phantom's messages and sometimes copied them down verbatim. The messages created an aura around the Phantom and confirmed the legends of his genius. Frank Wilczek, a physicist at the Institute for Advanced Study who lives in Einstein's old house on Mercer Street, was an assistant professor at the university at the time. He remembered feeling intrigued and impressed, and in the presence of a great mind. Mark Schneider, a physics professor at Grinnell, who was a graduate student in 1979, recalled, "We all found the remarkable connections, level of detail, and breadth of knowledge exceptional, which is why I collected a few dozen of the best of these." Shortly after Hironaka won a Fields Prize for his brilliant proof of the resolution of singularities, one of Nash's messages read, "N to the fifth power plus I to the fifth power plus X to the fifth power plus O to the fifth power plus N to the fifth power equals zero. Can Hironaka resolve this singularity?" Some of the messages seemed purely mathematical, at least until one looked at them more closely, as in this 1979 message, "Open letter to Professor Heisuke Hironaka. Zero equals E1 to the fifth power plus V to the 22nd power plus E2 to the fifth power plus R to the 18th power plus E3 to the fifth power plus T1 to the 19th power plus T2 to the 20th power. The above algebraic variety of dimension 6, represented in a fine 7 space, is singular, having a point singularity at the origin 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 of the coordinates. The question is, how singular, comparatively, is the above 6 variety, that is, what is the comparative degree of its singularity, compared with other singularities of such a sort as to provide standards of comparison? Others contained indirect references to past events. Indian limbo. B equals the quantity R times X to the 7th power plus the quantity M times O to the 6th power plus the quantity O times P to the 5th power plus the quantity Q times U to the 4th power plus the quantity M times E to the 3rd power plus the quantity O times T to the 2nd power plus A times P. T times O suggests occupational therapy, as in Dr. O.T. Beadle, M.D., A times P equals P times R times 2 minus 1 as a number. And still others were slyly humorous. True or false question. Statement. President Jimmy Carter is suffering from the disease of xanthochromatosis, the same disease which previously affected the careers of Nixon and Agnew, so that the disease has presumably jumped the gap of the apparently immune Northern Republicans Ford and Rockefeller, and reinfected Air Force One via the person of Jimmy Carter. The above statement is true, the above statement is false. During one period, all the messages featured a commentator named Yahya Fontana, who made mysterious pronouncements about current events, principally in the Middle East. In another period, Alexandra Grothendieck's name appeared frequently. In still another, Diophantine equations, equations like x to the nth power plus y to the nth power equals z to the nth power, dominated. Margaret Wertheim, author of Pythagoras's Trousers, A History of Numerology, has pointed out that people look to the order of numbers when the world falls apart. Nash's romance with numerology blossomed when his world was falling apart, suggesting once again that delusions, like mystical, cultic, religious efflorescence, aren't merely the ravings of madmen, but conscious, painstaking, and often desperate attempts to make sense out of chaos. Nash was making up numbers out of names and was often extremely worried about what he found. He was quite agitated when he thought that the numbers were portents of something serious, recalled Peter Ziffra, the head librarian at Fine Hall. Hale Trotter, a mathematician on the Princeton faculty, recalled, "I'd say hello, and he'd initiate a conversation. I remember one in which he was very concerned about the similarity of the telephone number of the United States Senate and the telephone number of the Kremlin. He was doing the arithmetic correctly, but the reasoning for it was crazy." Nash did a lot of telephoning in those years. Early on, Peter Ziffer remembers, Nash tried to call public figures as well as people at the university. It was a little odd. He wanted to talk about something that had been in the paper. A crisis in Russia that he wanted to talk about with somebody. William Browder, who was now chairman of the mathematics department, recalled, "Nash was the greatest numerologist the world has ever seen. He would do these incredible manipulations with numbers. One day he called me and started with the date of Khrushchev's birth, and worked right through to the Dow Jones average. He kept manipulating and putting in new numbers. What he came out with at the end was my social security number. He didn't say it was my social security number, and I wouldn't admit that it was. I tried not to give him the satisfaction. Nash was never trying to convince anyone of anything. He was doing things from a scholarly point of view. Everything he talked about always had a very scientific flavor. He was trying to gain an understanding of something. It was pure numerology, not applied." One has a distinct sense that Nash's condition had stabilized. To go to the blackboard took courage. To share ideas that Nash felt were important, and yet that might seem crazy to others, implied a willingness to make connections with the community at large. To stay in one place and not to run away, to labor at articulating his delusions in a way that attracted an audience that valued them, must be seen as evidence of some progression back to consensual forms of reality and behavior. And at the same time, to have his delusions seen not just as bizarre and unintelligible, but as having an intrinsic value, was surely one aspect of these lost years that paved the way for an eventual remission. As James Glass, the author of Private Terror, Public Places, and Delusion, put it upon hearing about Nash's years in Princeton, It seemed to serve as a containing place for his madness. It is obvious that for Nash, Princeton functioned as a therapeutic community. It was quiet and safe. Its lecture halls, libraries, and dining halls were open to him. Its members were for the most part respectful. Human contact was available, but not intrusive. Here he found what he so desperately wanted in Roanoke: safety, freedom, friends. As Glass put it, being freer to express himself without fearing that someone would shut him up or fill him up with medication must have helped pull him out of his disastrous retreat into hermetic linguistic isolation. Roger Lewin, a psychiatrist at Shepherd Pratt in Baltimore, said, "It seems that Nash's schizophrenia diminished in the way it appeared to others, and that his madness became confined to intellectual and delusional projections rather than to wrapping him completely in behavioral expressions." These are descriptions similar to those Nash himself has given of these years in Princeton. "I thought I was a messianic godlike figure with secret ideas. I became a person of delusionally influenced thinking, but of relatively moderate behavior, and thus tended to avoid hospitalization and the direct attention of psychiatrists." The immense effort, the reading, computations, and writing of producing the messages may have played a role in preventing Nash's mental capacities from deteriorating. The messages had their own history and evolved over time. At some point, probably starting in the mid-1970s, Nash began writing epigrams and epistles based on calculations in Base 26. Base 26, of course, uses 26 symbols, the number of letters in the English alphabet, just as the base 10 of everyday arithmetic employs the integers 0 through 9. Thus, if a calculation came out right, it produced actual words. Here was Nash, who as a boy had delighted in inventing secret codes, with his great mathematical ability and mystical preoccupations, and with plenty of time on his hands, taking names, converting them into numbers based on the letter-number correspondence, factoring the resulting numbers, and then comparing the primes in the hope of discovering secret messages. Daniel Feinberg, a graduate student of economics who ran into Nash at the Computer Center around 1975, recalled, "Nash had an obsessive concern with Nelson Rockefeller. He would take the letters, assign numbers to each letter, get a very large number, and then analyze that number for hidden meaning. It had the same relationship to mathematics as astrology to astronomy." This, of course, is not only time-consuming, but remarkably difficult, and the odds of finding meaningful words or combinations of words minute. Nash worked on one of those old-fashioned Friedan Marchant calculators with a tiny, glowing green CRT. He must have written an algorithm for doing base 26 arithmetic. Performing these calculations would have been tremendously tedious, and would have required writing down intermediate results as he went along, since these calculators had very little storage capacity and weren't programmable. Generating the equations that constituted the core of his blackboard messages was not just fancy arithmetic, however. As one of the former physics students remarked, "It would have taken deep abstraction of the sort that real mathematicians perform." On one occasion, Feinberg wrote a computer program for Nash. "He asked me if computer programming was something he should do. He'd seen me working with computers. He wanted to factor a 12-digit number, which he felt was a composite number. He had already tested it against the first 70,000 primes on a desk calculator. He had done it twice. He'd found no mistake, but he hadn't found a factor. I said we could do it. It took only about 5 minutes to write the program and test it. The answer came back. His number was a composite number that was the product of two primes." Nash was beginning to develop an interest in learning how to use the computer. If one spent time in the computing center, one had to sit at those ancient desk calculators by the hour, shuffling decks of computer cards. Hale Trotter, who was working half-time in the computer center in those days, described it. "It was the old days. We fed cards into the computer. There was a large ready room with a big counter, a card reader, table and chairs, and another room with a calculator. There was always lots of paper around." At the time, Trotter recalled, he kept track of people's computer time, but nobody was billed. At some point, the administration decided that he had to charge individual research accounts. Students and faculty alike had to open accounts and get passwords. Trotter initially told Nash that Nash could use his account number. At weekly meetings, the subject of regularizing the situation with Nash came up. Some students were wondering what was going on with Trotter's name on Nash's output. Someone suggested, said Trotter, "Why not give him his own account?" Everybody agreed to give him a free account. He never made any trouble. If anything, he was embarrassingly diffident. Sometimes, if one was having a conversation with Nash, it was hard to break away. For most of the 1970s, Nash conducted his elaborate researches in the reference room of Firestone Library, where he was known to successive generations of students as the Library Crazy Man, and later as the Mad Genius of Firestone. In the late 1970s, he was often the last to leave the library at midnight. He spent evenings in the reference room, his floppy golf hat on the broad wooden table with a neat pile of books. He could spend 2 or 3 hours standing at the card catalog. Charles Gillespie, a historian of science and editor of the Dictionary of Scientific Biography, had an office on the third floor of Firestone Library. Every day Nash would arrive at Firestone, marching down the walk, eyes straight ahead and briefcase in hand. He almost always headed for the third floor stacks, in a section of the library devoted to religion and philosophy. Gillespie always said good morning. Nash was always silent. Nash did, however, occasionally strike up acquaintanceships, as when he got to know 2 Iranian students during the summer of 1975. Amir Asadi, a big, smiling bear of a man, now on the mathematics faculty at the University of Wisconsin, recalled, "My brother spent the summer with me while I was studying for my generals. He used to wait for me in the common room. I'd seen Nash around and heard about him. But one day when I walked in, he and my brother were talking intensely, and I joined him. After that, I always said hello, and we talked occasionally. He was extremely gentle and very shy. He seemed just so lonely. We were among the few people who talked to him, but he spoke freely to my brother. I suppose he saw a lonely foreigner. Usually the conversations were quite short, but sometimes he would go on and on. It seemed scholarly to us. He didn't act bizarre. He used to read the Encyclopedia Britannica. He had enormous knowledge. Nash was interested in Zoroastrian religion. Zarathustra was an ancient Iranian prophet. He wasn't mad. He wasn't someone who had a yellow camel, i.e. crazy. The religion he founded was based on 3 principles: good deeds, good thoughts, good expressions. Fire was holy. Light and darkness were always locked in struggle. Fires always burn in Zoroastrian temples. They're monotheists. Nash would ask us to verify this and that. Occasionally we went and really read something. In Iran, the sense of sympathy and deep regret for a person being lonely is very great. We felt sorry. Nash's daily rounds in those years followed a predictable pattern. He would get up, not too early, and ride the dinky into town, buy a copy of the New York Times, walk over to Olden Lane, eat breakfast or lunch at the Institute, and wander back to the university, where he could be found either in Fine or in Firestone. For some time he became a regular at Fine Hall Teas. The year Joseph Cohn became chairman of the math department, 1972, Cohn spent many sleepless nights over Nash. Some of the math department secretaries had come to him at various times, saying that Nash's behavior worried them. Cohn couldn't remember exactly what the behavior was, but guessed that it involved staring. In any case, he brushed the women's complaints aside, saying that there was nothing to worry about. But privately, he wasn't so sure. With a few exceptions, such as Trotter, the faculty tended to avoid him. Claudia Golden, who was on the economics faculty at the time, recalled, "He was an intriguing mystery. He just seemed to be around. Here was this giant, and all of us were standing on his shoulders. But what kind of shoulders were they?" For academics, there's always this fear. All you have is your brain. The idea that anything could go wrong with it is so threatening. It's threatening for everybody, of course, but for academics, that's all of it. Mostly it was students who knew a bit of his legend, who generally found him non-threatening, who sought him out. Feinberg, for example, had lunch with Nash. Everyone knew he was a great man, and just having lunch was an interesting experience. It was sad, also. Here was this presence, this very famous person in our midst, that people outside of Princeton often thought was dead. In 1978, largely thanks to the kindness of his old friend from graduate school and Rand, Lloyd Shapley, Nash was finally awarded a mathematical prize. He was awarded the John von Neumann Theory Prize by the Operations Research Society and the Institute for Management Science, jointly with Carl Lemke, a mathematician of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Nash won for his invention of non-cooperative equilibrium, Lemke for his work in computing Nash equilibria. Lloyd Shapley was on the prize committee. It was his idea. "I felt sentiment and nostalgia," he recalled. Shapley, having received the honor himself the year before, thought, "Here's a chance to do something for Nash." He was motivated, he later said, by the hope that honoring Nash would somehow help Alicia and Johnny. "My sentiment, such as it was based on picturing him growing up. Here's this kid growing up and his dad isn't there. This might do something to increase his self-esteem. His father isn't there, but he's great. His work is being recognized." Nash was not, however, invited to the prize ceremony in Washington. Instead, Alan Hoffman, a mathematician at IBM and the second member of the prize committee, went down to Princeton to present Nash with the award. He said, "We gathered in Al Tucker's office. Al and Harold Kuhn were there, so we chatted a while. Nash was sitting in the corner. Let me tell you, seeing this man who was a genius and now functioning at sub-adolescent level really was tragic. There's a difference between knowing and seeing." Chapter 46. A Quiet Life. Princeton, 1970-90. "I have been sheltered here and thus avoided homelessness." John Nash, 1992. When Alicia offered to let Nash live with her in 1970, she was moved by pity, loyalty, and the realization that no one else on earth would take him in. His mother was dead, his sister unable to accept the burden. Alicia was, divorced or no, his wife. Whatever her reservations about living with her mentally ill ex-husband, they played no role in her thinking. She was simply not prepared to turn her back on him. Alicia also was moved by the conviction that she had something more to offer Nash than physical shelter. She believed, perhaps somewhat wishfully, that living in an academic community among his own kind, without the threat of further hospitalization, would help him get well. She took Nash's own assessment of his needs, for safety, freedom, and friendship, literally. In a letter to Martha written at Nash's request in late 1968, when he was convinced that his mother and sister planned to hospitalize him again, Alicia had argued that hospitalization was unnecessary and harmful. "Much of his past hospitalization I now feel was a mistake and had no beneficial permanent effects, rather the opposite. If he is to make a lasting adjustment, I think this has to be done under normal conditions." In 1968, Alicia had attributed her change of heart not just to the fact that Nash had relapsed despite aggressive treatment, but more important to her own experiences since her divorce, which gave her new insights into Nash's plight. She wrote to Martha, "I feel that I now understand his difficulties much better than I ever did in the past, having experienced some of his type of problems personally." Like many of those who tried to help Nash, Alicia was moved by a very personal and direct identification with his suffering. Alicia's beauty and vulnerability, a mix made even more potent because of her history of personal tragedy, made it likely that someone would fall in love with her. 40-something, a professor of mathematics, John Coleman Moore, might have inhabited the pages of an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel rather than an office at Fine Hall. His dark good looks, formal manners, and custom-made suits distinguished him from the rather scruffy ranks of fellow mathematicians, and his command of French and intimate knowledge of his native New York and assorted European capitals lent him a sophisticated aura. A bachelor, Moore was also a ladies' man. When they returned from their separate years in Paris, Moore, Nash, and Alicia sometimes had dinners à trois. But it wasn't until after the Nash's divorce in mid-1963, and after Moore, described by a former girlfriend as rigid and prim, suffered a devastating mental collapse of his own, that the relationship turned romantic. Plagued by alcoholism and severe depression, Moore was hospitalized at a swank, psychoanalytically oriented hospital outside Philadelphia. During 2.5 lonely years in which Moore remained in the hospital, other than Donald Spencer and George Whitehead, his thesis advisor from MIT, Alicia was his only regular visitor. Whitehead, who ran into Alicia a few times there, recalled, "There were lots of people in P-Town who didn't come and see him. He was remarkably thankful for visitors." The friendship, born out of shared experiences and mutual sympathy, blossomed into romance. Moore returned to Princeton and his teaching duties in the summer of 1965, about the same time that Nash moved to Boston. He became Alicia's regular escort at Princeton dinner parties, concerts, and the like. Whether it was a great love match, as her marriage to Nash had been, isn't clear. Moore, for all his charm and kindness, had little of the sort of charisma that had attracted Alicia so wildly to Nash. She yearned for someone who would take care of her, though, and for some time it appeared that they would marry. At the time that Nash left Princeton, Alicia was still working at RCA. Her mother, who moved in with her after the death of her husband, kept house for Alicia as she had done in Cambridge years earlier. Mrs. Larday also helped take care of Johnny, who had grown into an extremely bright and altogether adorable boy, tall, sweet-faced, and still very blonde. Things started to unravel when Alicia suddenly lost her job at RCA. The company's space division had been periodically buffeted by contract cancellations and layoffs. Alicia, who was frequently absent, often late or simply too depressed when she was at work to be effective, was particularly vulnerable. She found another job fairly quickly, but it didn't last. She could not seem to get on her feet again. For a grim period that lasted several years, she drifted from job to job and was frequently unemployed, a fact to which she alluded obliquely in her letter to Martha. Alicia was determined to get a job that matched her educational credentials, but few aerospace companies were hiring female engineers in that era, and Alicia was turned down for more than 30 such positions. "There were times when I was going to interviews every day, all day," she later recalled. "But I never got any offers. It was very depressing." Things got so bad after her unemployment benefits ran out that she was forced to go on welfare and to use food stamps. Her hope of marrying Moore came to nothing. He backed away, finding the prospect of taking on a stepson as well as a wife too much. Her mother held everything together, as Alicia later said, but it was very hard. Alicia and her mother were forced to give up the nice house they were sharing on Franklin Street in the heart of Princeton proper. Alicia found a tiny 19th-century frame house in Princeton Junction, long ago swathed in insel brick, to rent. It was in poor repair, but cheap and convenient for commuting since it was literally across the road from the railroad station. Johnny, who was 12 by this time, was extremely unhappy over having to leave his school and friends. But Alicia had little choice. Nash moved to the Junction with her, contributing some of his small income from the trust left by Virginia to pay the rent and household expenses. Alicia referred to him as a boarder, but in fact they ate meals together, and Nash spent a fair amount of time with Johnny, sometimes helping him with his homework or playing chess with him. Alicia had taught her son, who would later become a chess master, how to play. Nash was very withdrawn, very quiet. He was not a troublemaker, Odette recalled. Haphazardly dressed, his gray hair long, his expression blank, he would wander up and down Nassau Street. Teenagers would taunt him, planting themselves in his path, waving their arms, shouting rude things directly into his startled face. Alicia was a proud woman, always sensitive to appearances. Her loyalty and compassion outweighed her concern for what others might think. She was patient. She bit her tongue. She made very few demands on Nash. Looking back, her gentle manner probably played a substantial role in his recovery. Had she threatened or pressured Nash, he very well might have wound up on the street. This point was made by Richard Keefe, a psychiatrist at Duke University. Contrary to conventional wisdom, which held that families of the mentally ill should let it all out, more recent research suggests that people with schizophrenia are no more able to tolerate the expression of strong emotion than patients recovering from a heart attack or cancer surgery. Alicia was a scrupulously honest person. She says of the role she has played in protecting Nash simply, "Sometimes you don't plan things, they just turn out that way." She does see that it helped him, though, saying, "Did the way he was treated help him get better? Oh, I think so. He had his room and board, his basic needs taken care of, and not too much pressure. That's what you need, being taken care of and not too much pressure."